Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me too. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea.
Hi. How's the clematis you planted last week in a kind of mad effusion of optimism survived the snow?
Well, I mean, I did look at it and think, you poor thing, and I'm sorry. Though it is supposed to be winter flowering. It's all right. Yeah, but it's all right. It's got it's a bit broken. It's a bit sorry for itself. I got carried away.
But I hope you've learned a lesson from this.
Well,
like, no probably, optimism.
probably not. The one thing I did this week, bearing on what we've talked about before, is I read another Cazalet.
Confusion.
I got Confusion, the book, not the state, though the state may well be, inherent. And I finished that one, which is the one which is mostly set during the war, as it happens.
Mm.
And I think, you know, it's really wonderful. And also, I can't wait to finish it, but everyone's having such a bad time. I'm not sure I'm enjoying it. Do you know what I mean?
And also now you've reached beyond, because there are five books, so you've reached beyond the halfway point now that you're at the end of the third. Is there a sort of melancholy creeping in now as you know you're on the downhill slope?
Very much so. And also because, you know, a lot of people are having a really bad time. And I was struck actually in it, partly because we're going to talk about anti-Semitism, aren't we, a little bit later on the podcast. There's a bit about it in the book. So there's hardly any politics or anything about the war that's kind of going on in the background. But there are a few bits right at the end which deal with the camps and the dawning realization of what's been happening. And they're very strong. That it's like being punched in the gut, which it should be, and it's difficult to read. And I thought, actually, I haven't read that very much in fiction, really, and especially since it's a milieu that wouldn't necessarily have paid much attention to it. And then they have to, and you know, they meet a couple of people and talk to a couple of people, and the horror of it is really brought home, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And as you say, because it's embedded in a book that doesn't otherwise necessarily deal with that, and there's so much chatter in the book. It's such a multivocal voice that it's quite a loud book. There's a lot of chatter going on, and then all of a sudden you get these glimpses of the world beyond England, beyond Sussex and London, which is where mostly think the events are set. So book four, you need to see about getting your hands on that one now.
Okay, that's my aim.
Right, well, coming up on this week's show, a few things to consider watching or listening to when you're not reading the Cazalet Chronicles, from a food podcast made with eaters rather than foodies in mind to a French comedy drama about actors and their often exasperated agents. We'll also have a clip from a conversation between the writer and comedian David Baddiel and our politics editor Toby Lichtig, in which they discuss Baddiel's book Jews Don't Count, the premise of which is that while people are fighting the good fight against discrimination in its many forms, most of them appear to overlook one of the most persecuted minorities in history. But first, the Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa, a titan of Spanish language literature, winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature, has a new book out, which would be an event in any case, but seems all the more so given the book's surprising subject. One could, on first glimpsing Medio Siglo con Borges, half a century with Borges, be forgiven for incredulity. Mario Vargas Llosa publishing a book on Jorge Luis Borges, surely no two writers could be more different. So writes David Gallagher, the Chilean ambassador in London, who has reviewed Vargas Llosa's volume alongside another alleged encounter with Borges, note the emphasis there on alleged, by the American writer and critic Jay Perini. And David Gallagher joins us on the line from Chile now to tell us more about these literary meetings. Hello, David.
Well, thank you very much. Very good to be on this programme. Well, I always thought that it was intriguing to have Mario Vargas Llosa write about Borges. Borges was always very rude about novelists. He thought that novelists took far too much time to say things that one could summarize in a few sentences. Borges sometimes summarizes imaginary novels, which he thinks up, and that's his. The closest he gets to novels, and he always said that he didn't really read novels, particularly he didn't read novels of his contemporaries, because he thought that his contemporaries were too much like him. So here is the great Latin American novelist Mario Vargas Llosa writing about this great Argentinian writer who's sort of hostile to novels. So that I thought sort of rather intriguing.
Well, and it's true that, I mean, you say, so Vargas Llosa is interested in philosophy. You know, Borges's stories and fragments, they're cerebral puzzles, and they delve into these philosophical conundrums. And Vargas Llosa is himself interested in philosophy in his essays, but not in his novels. So there's this kind of double disjuncture almost. So where, in what way do they meet? Because this is a sort of 60 years in the making book, isn't it?
That's right. It's starting in the 60s. And what Vargas Llosa tells us was that he when he was in Peru, was a very young writer. He was very much under the aegis of Jean-Paul Sartre and the idea that writers had to be committed, socially committed, politically committed. But he was intrigued by Borges's reputation. So he started reading Borges at night when nobody could see him, sort of clandestinely. And he became fascinated. And what he says is one of the first things that really struck him was Borges's prose style. Borges writes a much simpler Spanish than was normal at the time. And there's a rather good quote by Vargas Llosa. He says that the work of our great prose writers, beginning with Cervantes, are like firework displays in which each idea is placed in a parade led and followed by a sumptuous court of butlers, gallants, and pages who are there for pure decoration. Whereas Borges goes to the core of what he's trying to express, and shows that Spanish can be used to discuss complex concepts in a way that Spanish hadn't been able to do before.
That wonderful way of describing the use of language matches Borges's own excellent descriptions of how language is used. Another quote that you have in your piece, he said, and this is Borges now, he says, he once wrote that Spaniards love synonyms because they allow for a change of noise without the effort of a change of idea.
Right.
Another thing that's quite that's very interesting, intriguing, even on the note of language and how Borges kind of reshaped the Spanish language or turned it to his own ends, is the notion that there should be some English influence. That's interesting. It's not as culturally self-centered as it might at first sound, is it?
Well, I think that I mentioned that Borges reads very well in English translation, and I think that tells you something. He was brought up pretty well bilingually. I mean, he was also, he knew a lot of French. And so I think the influence of English is quite strong in his prose.
I was reading about his own, because as you say, he was brought up, it was his grandmother, I think, wasn't it, who was English, and he was brought up speaking English and studying and reading and writing English. And I found someone had asked him how, what books he would put in his own personal library, because he was so, you know, because he was a librarian and he did the Library of Babel. And so someone came up with this. And, you know, I suppose you never know how serious he was in any of these answers. But he did give a lot of examples of books. And but the English language ones, I was struck by, it's very sort of high Victorian, early Edwardian. It's Jack London and H.G. Wells and Chesterton and Kipling. It's very... it's rather kind of gothic and old-fashioned. I was very surprised by that.
Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, I think that they were the books that were given to him by his grandmother and by his English governess. And one gets the impression that he read an enormous amount when he was very young, and then probably read quite a lot less. So he's very out of date in his reading. I mean, I don't think he's just pulling a fast one. I mean, I think it's really true that is his what he most read.
But it sounds like a rather old-fashioned list from someone who was doing something so new and so unlike all of the things that he's describing.
Exactly. No, it's true.
So how did these two men, who were in many ways quite different, I mean, one was a precursor of the other, but more than anything, how is it that they... overcame, I mean, you know, one of them disparages novels, the other writes them. One of them is very much in a kind of a realist vein, Vargas Llosa is, compared to Borges. How did they come together, and what kind of relationship did they have? What was their rapport?
Well, I can only go by the by this book. I mean, I think Vargas Llosa was an enormous admirer of Borges, met him a few times and read him avidly, and it's unlikely that Borges would have read Vargas Llosa, because you know, he simply didn't read novels. Borges was always a colossus of Latin American literature from the 60s onwards, and I think that probably a lot of Latin American novelists were influenced by him. I'm quite sure that García Márquez was influenced by him. And there are certain scenes in 100 Years of Solitude which one could describe as a homage to Borges. The way that that the whole of Macondo in 100 Years of Solitude disappears when on the last page of the novel is a sort of homage to a story by Borges called The Search of Averroes, when he stops writing everything that surrounds him, including the Guadalquivir River, disappears. It was quite influential. I mean, it was certainly taken up by García Márquez. I mean, I think that Borges was so good, really, that nobody could not read him.
Two diamonds in the kind of display of essays and articles and a poem in this collection by Vargas Llosa are interviews. The first was conducted in the 60s and the second 20 years later, I think, not long before Borges's death. The descriptions here sound so rich and moving of going to Borges's apartment in the 1980s. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, it's a wonderful description, because you know, that apartment has been written about by other people. Vargas Llosa has this wonderful novelist eye, and he notices things which other people didn't notice. So he finds Borges in a suit with a tie, and imagines Borges is like that, dresses like that in his apartment, even if he's not visited by anyone. Which I think is, I'm sure, is right. And then he goes into Borges's bedroom. He finds that Borges's bed is a narrow bed, rather fragile-looking bed, which he describes as being like the bed of a child. And he notices on the wall a Peruvian decoration, which is the Order of the Sun, hanging on the wall. And any Vargas Llosa would have known what that decoration was. So he asked Borges about it. Why do you have that? And Borges explains that he was given this decoration by the Peruvians, and he was very proud to receive it because his great-grandfather's ancestor, Colonel Suarez, had received it for leading a cavalry charge in the Battle of Junin in 1824. So he's terribly proud to receive this decoration, which his ancestor received. The description of the books that Borges has, which I thought quite amusing. I don't think I was, when I went into that apartment once, I don't think I was nosy enough to peruse the books on the bookshelves. And in the main bookshelf, not all that many books for a start, nothing by Borges himself and nothing on Borges.
I mean, I must say that reflects quite well on him, doesn't it?
I think it does, actually, absolutely. I mean, I've seen writers' bookshelves full of 30 translations of their latest novel, that sort of thing. And Borges certainly, I know, never read anything written about him.
Well, you say that he used to really dislike being spoken to about his own work. It used to make his hackles go up almost to have to talk about his stories and have people pick them apart.
Yes, I think he found that very boring, and he was probably a bit flattered. You never know, but he was really rude to anyone who tried to interpret a story. I mean, he would say something like, "Oh, that's extraordinarily interesting. I never thought of that."
Did he? Did you witness some of this, David?
Well, I did, yes, yeah, because I was at a time when I was lecturing Latin American literature at Oxford, I was going to do a book on Borges. And I spent quite a lot of time in Buenos Aires digging up things which hadn't made book form and so on, and talking to him, and, you know, I would be tempted to interpret some story for him. I very quickly learned that... you know, I was just inviting some rude riposte.
it seems safe to say that you recognize Borges in Vargas Llosa's portrait quite strongly. Does he capture the tricksiness that you yourself witnessed in Oxford when he came to visit? You tell a great story. Perhaps you could tell it again.
Yes. Well, when he came to Oxford for an honorary DPhil, which we gave him at Oxford, he would not recognize any individual. So Robert Lowell had been very keen to be with Borges because he'd actually taken Borges around Harvard a few months before. So when they're about to have dinner together, or we're about to have a dinner with both of them, we introduce Robert Lowell to Borges, saying, "Borges, this is Robert Lowell," making allowances for his blindness, and Borges looks black. And so we then say, "Well, the American poet."
You have to add his type.
Well, Borges starts to recite Walt Whitman.
So how awkward.
And he knew perfectly well who Robert Lowell was, because Robert Lowell, I know that he knew who Robert Lowell was. And you know, the same thing happened with Iris Murdoch, who was at the party. I mean, you know, we invited the great and the good of Oxford to meet Borges, but he wouldn't recognize the individuality of anyone. And that
he's in a mischievous mood.
Exactly. I mean, it's one had to know that when one got accustomed to it.
It's sometime just before this episode that you've just recounted, this episode in Oxford, which definitely did happen, that the trip at the heart of Jay Perini's curious contribution, let's say curious for now, apparently took place. What's going on here? What's going on in this book? It's quite baffling in a way.
It's an incredible book. I had read The Last Station, which was a book that Jay Perini wrote about the last year of Tolstoy, which made a film, which I think, you know, a lot of people saw, and it was a very good film. But he called that a novel. Okay, so whereas this book he doesn't cast as a novel, but more as a memoir. So what happens? Jay Perini goes to St Andrews to do a doctorate in St Andrews on a Scottish poet, and he becomes friendly with Alistair Reid, who translator of Borges, who lives in St. Andrews. And Alistair Reid becomes a sort of mentor of his. Jay Perini doesn't know who Borges is. And anyway, Borges arrives, and Alistair Reid suddenly rings Jay Perini up and says, look, I've got this friend, a sort of great uncle, who's not terribly well, so I have to go to London. Could you look after Borges? It won't be more than a week or so. And that seems incredible. It is so improbable. I mean, Alistair Reid is a very good translator of Borges, and I knew him pretty well. And I just simply cannot imagine Alistair Reid leaving Borges with a student he'd only met 2 or 3 weeks before.
But and what apparently happens is then the two men, Jay Perini and Borges, get into a series of train planes and automobiles and have all sorts of adventures in the Highlands. Again, it's increasingly sounding increasingly unlikely.
Well, exactly. I mean, Perini has a really ramshackle car which he shares with another student, and Borges says to Perini, "I'd like to see the Highlands." So off they go. Borges is supposed to be Don Quixote. Perini is Sancho Panza, and the car is Rocinante, the horse that Don Quixote rode. And they go on this adventure through the Highlands. I mean, they get to Inverness because Borges wants to meet Mr. Singleton, who's an expert on Anglo-Saxon literature. And he has the address in Inverness, but it turns out to be in Inverness in New Zealand. Then Borges, who practically didn't drink at all, I mean, he might have taken a sip of wine, has 3 pints of beer in a pub. And then they spend the night in a sort of bed sit where Perini and Borges share a bed, which, I mean, you know, I think is a bit extraordinary, and Borges obviously has to get up in the night every 5 minutes because he had so much beer, and he the bathroom is in the sort of rather dour landlady's bedroom. Borges charges into the wind, quoting King Lear, and falls and is unconscious and has to spend the night in hospital.
And I suppose all of this would be, you know, one thing, I suppose, if it were being framed as fiction, but it isn't. And the suggestion of a legal dimension coming in, perhaps, on publication.
Well, Borges's widow has been very litigious, and she sued an Argentinian writer who did an expanded version of El Aleph, which is the story of Borges is about a point in space which contains all the rest of space. I think that, you know, to be fair to Perini, I mean, I think he makes a lot of, the claims he makes are so outrageous that I think he's teasing the reader. I assume he is. I mean,
perhaps it's supposed to be a kind of Borgesian prank.
Well, exactly. That's right. And you know, he keeps on quoting Borges's belief that the line between reality and fiction is always necessarily extremely thin, assuming there's any line at all. So he gives a lot of clues to the fact that all this may be a fantasy. I mean, all that he says, all that Perini says about Alistair Reid is very plausible because, you know, I knew Alistair Reid enough to imagine that most of what he says there is plausible. Jay Perini describes Alistair Reid, you know, baking these hash brownies quite often, and which I find plausible because we're in the... I don't know, late 1971, I think it's quite plausible. I can't remember Alistair offering me a hash brownie, but maybe he did.
Well, maybe that's the point. Maybe that's the problem.
I was about to say, if you could remember it, maybe.
It's absolutely amazing to have Borges following hash brownies. But anyway, there it is. He does, according to this book.
Well, I mean, it sounds like there's the kernel of a story that has just gone completely, just run away, really. And this book is going to be published in the UK later this year. So the story keeps on coming. David Gallagher, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Still to come on the show, a snippet from an interview with David Baddiel about his new book, Jews Don't Count, written, he says, for people who consider themselves to be on the right side of history, and an idiosyncratic roundup of the month's watching and listening. If you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, this is a gentle reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast for free via pretty much any podcast provider, I think, so you will never miss an episode.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson, a weekly series of in-depth interviews with high-profile figures examining how overcoming the challenges of their early lives shaped the people they've become. This week, Ann Summers CEO Jacqueline Gold talks candidly about her parents' divorce and how she coped with a shocking period of childhood sexual abuse.
They say the best form of revenge is success, and I believe that. It was just turning something negative into a positive.
Past Imperfect with Rachel Sylvester and Alice Thompson. Jacqueline Gold, in her own words, now available as a podcast. Listen on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, and before we move on to comfort food and I quote the most wonderful speech never made at Cannes, we've a clip to play you from a conversation between David Baddiel, author of the book-length essay Jews Don't Count, and the TLS's politics editor Toby Lischtig. Toby began by asking what it is about the very word Jew that seems to make people squirm.
Yeah, well, we could probably spend the whole podcast talking about that. One of the things I've noticed since the book's been knocking about on social media, in terms of like me putting out pictures of the cover and talking about it, is a few people have said, oh, I don't know whether or not I'm interested, but I don't know if I'd be happy reading that in public. It's kind of a provocative title, yes, but I think that's primarily about my sort of unvarnished use of the word Jew rather than Jewish person, although it's interesting how naff it would sound to say Jewish people don't count as a title, but Jews don't count has much more power. And part of that power is to do with the negativity and the negative energy that I think surrounds the word. In the book, I talk about this and I quote, actually, I take the liberty of quoting a bit from my 2004, is it, novel, The Secret Purposes, which is about the internment of Jewish German refugees on the Isle of Man, in which a translator, herself not Jewish, is trying to translate a Nazi woman's use of the phrase Judinnen. And Judinnen, I think, literally means Jewesses, but she can't get the sort of venom that the Nazi said the word into the word Jewesses. And to cut a long story short, in that bit, she realizes that the way to do it is to use the phrase Jew women rather than Jewish women or Jewesses. And I like that because I think it demonstrates how weirdly negative this word still is if you don't grammatically soften it with the suffix ish,
which in itself is quite funny. The idea, ish itself is a kind of a
Jewish thing. Yeah. And I've heard many times people saying I'm Jew-ish, meaning that I'm sort of Jewish, but you know, I wouldn't describe myself as an out-and-out Jew. Yeah, exactly. And as I was writing that bit, I think it came to me that it's remarkable how the difference between saying a Jewish banker, a Jewish boy, between Jew banker, Jew boy. That's all you need to make those things Nazi, really, and racist. And there is no other, I can't think of another word that would operate in that way. And I think what that demonstrates is the enormous sort of the singularity, the evil singularity of the word Jew. And I'm using singularity in the kind of physics sense there, that it's packed with the history of its own, the racism of years and years and years and years of Christian scapegoating of Jews as evil. That is why people have to say Jewish, and there isn't really another word that I can think of like that. So, yeah, when I decided to put my bio on Twitter as being just Jew, I'm aware of that. The weird thing is, it's also quite a funny word. I think for Jews, it's quite funny.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's funny, and one of the reasons it's funny is because it's so freighted, and because it confuses people. I mean, you know, Jews can embrace it. Non-Jews sort of squirm around and not quite sure what to do about it. And it's exactly that discomfort that you're exploiting with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's more widely what you're, you know, to a certain extent, that discomfort and that unsureness about where to place Jews is partly what your book's about. I mean, it's probably worth just talking a little bit more about precisely what it's aimed at, because there are loads of books about anti-Semitism. We've all read different takes on the long and bitter history and more recent examples, but yours is a little different. It's aimed specifically at a particular group, and I just wondered if you could talk a bit about what kind of anti-Semitism you're getting at here.
I mean, the book, in a very rather deliberate way, but to try and avoid confusion, I suppose, or misrepresentation, is a critique, I guess, of progressives or progressive discourse around, and specifically progressive discourse around identity politics and around ethnicity. Ethnicity primarily, but also around minorities. So minorities would also include, I would say, gender minorities and disabled people and all that kind of stuff. So just the sort of like the way in which progressive thinking, by progressive, I mean more than just the left. I mean a kind of wide swathe of people who would consider themselves, I guess, right thinking and liberal thinking, have become much more concerned in over the last 20 years with those kind of issues than they have about class, basically. That if those people might have defined themselves at one time as being primarily concerned about class and fighting some kind of class struggle, they now are fighting, I would say, more of an identity struggle, which is that all identities that are not white, Christian, mainstream, you know, cisgendered, straight men need to be, the conversation needs to be recentered away from that norm and taking into account the concerns and the identity of these other minorities. And it's those people I'm interested in, because it's those people for whom I think Jews still seem ambiguous within that concern. That Jews are still are the minority that they still don't quite know what to do with, where to place. Most people think of anti-Semitism in a very direct way. They think of the Nazis, basically, and or neo-Nazis or whoever, people who hate Jews, want to kill Jews, and it's a very active, direct form of hatred, and liberals are without doubt still would condemn that and would think it was bad, but the book is not about that, partly because I don't think that needs much deconstruction. Okay, I don't think, you know, people who hate Jews and want to kill Jews, that their utterances don't need to be deconstructed or thought about much. They just need to be resisted. What I'm talking about is something much more elusive than that, which is a series of absences, a series of lack of concerns, of being dismissive or not as worried about instances of offence towards Jews, which I believe, and that's the point of the polemic, if those instances were about other minorities, the same people would be up in arms about it. And so it's more about what's missing. It's what's not being said, what's not being applied to Jews. Some kind of safety or concern or protectiveness, which progressive people would normally apply, that is not happening to Jews.
The full interview will be released as a bonus episode in your podcast feed on Friday, so please do make sure to circle back for that. David Baddiel's book, Jews Don't Count, published by TLS Books, will be available from next week.
To turn to lighter things, if you're feeling a bit fed up in January, what with the global pandemic, the lockdowns, the weather and all that, we have some ideas here to cheer you up. One of the things we turn to in times like these is food, not always much else to do these days. And Alice Wadsworth, Deputy Fiction Editor at the TLS, has been listening to food-related podcasts and writing about them for us. And she's here on the podcast to talk to us about podcasts. We are nothing if not meta. Alice, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Hello.
So what's the first sort of food related podcast that you've been writing about?
The first one I look at is The Sporkful, which is hosted by Dan Pashman, who's gone through kind of the NPR This American Life roots of podcasting. And it's a very popular one and kind of looks at the anthropological scientific approaches behind why we enjoy the taste we do. And it can range. It's like, it's a nice mix of interviews. So LeVar Burton is one of my favorite ones, who talks about some recipes he enjoys in his favorite children's books, but then also studies into things like how certain noises might affect the way we taste things or how colors might affect our taste.
Which immediately makes me think of the futurist experiments when they kind of make you eat your dinner while stroking velvet with the sound of a motor droning in your left ear.
Who made you do that, Thea?
Not me personally, but Marinetti okay. did.
But there's a good one, isn't there, about planes, Alice?
Yes, that was one I was particularly like obsessed with because it's something I've noticed myself as well with plain food. Like, I quite like plain food. A lot of people hate it. I really enjoy it. But apparently it affects... It's the fact that it's not the things you would think that affect your taste. So I would have thought it was the dry cabin air that might affect your tongue or something, or the altitude, something like that. But it's the noise, the sound the plane makes affects the umami taste receptors in your tongue and makes them more, you know, open, whereas it suppresses the others, kind of like sweet and sour. So it makes us more inclined to like something like, for example, which I put in the piece, tomato juice.
I don't think, well, first of all, I don't think anything would make me want to tomato juice.
Sort of depends on whether it has vodka and Worcester sauce and celery
not
salts.
Even.
And, oh,
not
really?
Exactly. Is that why they serve it on planes and nowhere else in the world? I think that must be it. So this is, if it's come from This American Life and NPR, that's kind of podcast royalty, isn't it? And is it quite a serious listen, this one? It's kind of telling you things.
Yeah, you always come away with lots of different facts to spread about, which is great. And it is serious. It bounces between serious and not so serious. So the most recent one, which I didn't include in this particular write-up because it is particularly serious, is looking at eating disorders and how they affect men. So it can go into really, yeah, proper topics. But then it'll also be quite playful. Usually they'll go on one or two topics. And I particularly like it when Dan Pashman gets a bit Bill Nye the Science Guy about things. So there's one where he sets up an ice cream stand with his daughter to test out people's responses to essentially the color of the cone and things like that, and see if that's going to change how they enjoy the ice cream. So they do a few little experiments like that, which make it a bit more lighthearted.
There's an interesting line about how emotions influence the perception of flavor as well. One about a sporting contest.
Yeah, but it is genuinely true that if you lose in a game or something like that and then go out for pizza afterwards, like, it will taste more sour. They've done studies and it is verified that he will actually be bitter when you lose.
But it sort of makes you think that maybe that's how the whole, those descriptors became attached to certain things, you know, feeling sour about something.
Yeah.
Perhaps that's because in ancient times, someone realized that there was a, you know, an increase in the sourness of things.
Well, they lost it. I've lost my chariot race and now my olives taste bitter, like that.
Exactly.
So you're making it sound ridiculous, but it's possible.
I was just trying to think of an ancient sport. Ben-Hur sprang to mind. And what's the best recipe, do you reckon, Alice, in that one, in the sporkful?
In the sporkful? I mean, I kind of... my brain just whirred and stopped on the idea that Patrick Stewart likes eating apple and onion in a sandwich.
I was hoping you were going to say that because really? I could not handle that idea at all.
Wow.
What did he say? Why?
Is it alone or with something
else?
I know,
but like together, it just in a sandwich. And on set is the other part of it that I find weird because I will, there's strange things I'll eat, but I won't necessarily bring into the office to eat. But that is, yeah... feeling confident enough with your apple and onion, to like raw onion, not cooked, to bring in to the set is...
yeah. Imagine you had a love scene afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
I just don't think that's very considerate.
I think we're also going to have a separate podcast on the things that Alice will eat, but not in the TLS office.
Oh, yeah.
But not in the office.
Oh, there are many.
It will be called, but not in the
well,
office.
Now I've got lots more inspiration from these podcasts as well.
Okay, that's our new spin-off. Listen out for it. And the second podcast that you were talking about is more obviously sort of fun and chat and the rambly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Off Menu, which is, it's a wild, ridiculous dream restaurant. It's James Acaster, and he's already quite ridiculous, and Ed Gamble, who's a bit more straight man to James Acaster's kind of... he plays a genie, James Acaster. He's more of a genie waiter character who facilitates everyone's dreams and allows them to eat whatever they wish. But yeah, that's more a world of imagination, I guess.
It's a bit like Desert Island Discs or something. It's like your ideal meal, but it doesn't have to fit together. Is that
yeah,
right?
It doesn't have to fit together. That's one of the main bits, because some people really try and cram it all in. Like they'll do a starter that I think it was... I'm not sure who it was. Some people will do a starter, which is just various different dishes from their local Chinese. And then for the main course, we'll go into a Thanksgiving dinner, for example. So I don't think they're necessarily thinking about eating it all in one sitting, but it's just your absolute favourite.
We're not judging here.
Yeah.
I was judging the apple and onion sandwich, but I'm not now. Yeah, so that one's much chattier, isn't it? Because they, as you say, they know each other already. And they talk to, they're not always friends with the people, but they talk to fellow comedians, and it's more relaxed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit more kind of silly. And then also some people who already, like Joe Brand, obviously, like they play up humour related to food all the time. So their episode is particularly good as they go into five or six different types of coleslaw. But then when they get down to actually... delineating the differences between the different coleslaws, they, I think they only managed to do four or five rather than six.
But listen to the Joe Brand one, and she had mezze for her starter,
yeah.
But then took out most of the dishes brilliantly.
Yeah.
So there was like, well, tara masala, and I quite like hummus.
Yeah, it's being very, very picky is most people. Also, Victoria Coren Mitchell was particularly picky, which made both James Acaster and Ed Gamble very frustrated on the podcast. With her plans.
What's the worst dish or the worst dinner you think from Off Menu?
Ooh, I mean, it's got to be stuffed hot dog crust pizza because like that it's just too many things in one go.
Is that the crust of the pizza has got a hot dog in it?
Yeah, the whole
crust. It doesn't have the bun in it, does it?
No, I think the crust itself is the bun, and then it's cheese, and then hot dog.
That is disgusting. Who was that?
That was the first episode as well. That was Scroobius Pip on the first episode. So I think he kind of went in there, like, put down the gauntlet.
Yes, that's a good one. Thea,
I'm
a pizza aficionado.
I'm speechless.
I'm so sorry, Thea.
It's much worse than a Hawaiian, that, isn't it?
It's a whole other level.
Yeah, exactly. People are talking about pineapple and then there's hot dog crust.
I'm fine with a Hawaiian, but not with a hot dog stuffed crust. And then, Alice, you came across one more person, didn't you? Not strictly a podcaster. In your quest, as you say, to break away from, by your own admission, beans on toast and fish fingers, nothing wrong with any of those things. Tell us who else you came across.
In my defence, I had been listening to her in a way, I suppose, as much as watching. But this YouTuber I have found called Amelia Fart, who is just... I mean, I'm almost at a loss for words. They have so many words to describe themselves that it's hard to kind of pin some on them because they are really a bit of a performance artist. They do some cooking videos, some videos that are just telling secrets to strangers or having a breakdown in the toilet, for example. But generally the main message, whether it's cooking or anything else, is that they're being very brash, funny, saying whatever comes to their mind. And it's
and a lot of the things that, sorry, and a lot of the things that they're preparing are to be eaten in strange circumstances, aren't they? Like on a in a hot air balloon or on a Ferris wheel or whatever.
Oh yeah.
Specifically.
So one of the ones the recipe I haven't tried is a risotto that looks quite nice that they were doing in a public gym. That was obviously pre-COVID. But the one which is a really good recipe, is one for salmon tartare that they prepare in a library. But the thing is, to get the recipe, you do have to watch the video through, which you will not be able to cook along to the first time because she is ridiculous and you'll just be laughing.
But they really are in a library.
Yeah,
it's not a setup, is it? It's not staged.
No, it's a real library. Yeah, there are parts when there's a bit when you can see someone looking down the aisle of, like, you know, the particular part of the library that they're in, probably thinking that there's a book that they want down there, but maybe I won't go down there because there's a strange woman with a large knife and a bit of fish who seems to be making salmon tartare.
Yeah, muttering to the camera and saying, I'm so glad you picked this out because it was one of my favourite lines. And she's saying, no need to give yourself a hard time. Something like, it's not about being perfect. It's about being moderately adorable all the time.
Yeah. And then kind of stage whispering and then occasionally being like, am I screaming? I think I'm screaming.
Yeah, well, well done you for being able to make the recipes because I wasn't able to. But I very much enjoyed the silliness of it. Did you see it, Thea?
I can't say I have. No. I will do. I had never heard of Amelia Fart.
Not her real name, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I mean, proceed with caution because you watch one and you will end up watching 10 more.
Well, also we have to factor into my watching list that you're making for me here that I also have Lucy's things to add to it because Lucy, you've written the televisual side of things this week, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah, so for our audio visual page, so yes, Alice did the audio and I did the visual and I did Call My Agent. Which has the final fourth and final series has just come out on Netflix. So I wrote about it. I hope without any terrible spoilers.
Well, and so I seem to live under a rock increasingly, and I hadn't heard of this program. So it's in its fourth series, the fourth and final. And it's got, is it sort of a cult following thing or is it bigger than that?
I think maybe it was like that and now it's bigger. I think it's sort of gone international now. So obviously it started in France and it's set in a talent agency, actors mostly, in Paris, and is basically about what the agents get up to on behalf of their actors. And every episode is called by just a name, just the first name, like Julie or Cécile or Jean or something. And these are all French actors because each episode centres on the whatever that actor is getting up to and how the agent can get them out of it. So the actor wants to get out of a film and doesn't know how to, or wants to get into a film and doesn't know how to, or that, you know, that doesn't sound very interesting the way I'm saying it, but it's incredibly, it's very, very funny apart from anything else. It's very smart And you're just as interested in the agents and what they're doing, possibly more so as you are in the actors.
And the actors are, they tend to be real actors playing themselves, sort of sending themselves.
They
up.
Are real but actors. They always are. Yeah, they are. Yeah. So in the first series, they are actors that might not be that well known outside France, though they've got Nathalie Baye in the first one, so people might know her. And then, in the second series, the second series ends with Juliette Binoche.
Oh, so this is the Cannes speech that I referred to earlier.
Yes. There's this wonderful thing where she's the sort of MC of the Cannes Film Festival, and it begins with her trying on a dress, and she comes out in this kind of extraordinary dress, and her agent says it looks like Dalida. You know Dalida, who was a very kind of glam, slightly over the top 70s singer. She says, you look like Dalida. And Juliette Binoche says, yeah, if she had made love with a really, really big swan, because it's got sort of half a swan around it. And she looks sort of quite bonkers, but very glam.
She sounds like Bjork.
A bit, but yeah, but like as though she's tried to do Bjork. Yeah, a bit like that. And then then you go through the episode, and in the end she gives the speech at Cannes, but various things have happened backstage to her dress and her shoes and everything else. And it's rather brilliant because you watch her giving the speech, and she stops giving the real speech after a while and starts improvising. And at the beginning it's a car crash, and you watch the agents watching it. So we're watching them, do you see what I mean? There's two removes there. And you all have the same reaction. At the beginning, you're like, and then she starts pulling it round and making this brilliant speech about women in film and how wonderful it is and how important it is. And she sort of saves the day, and everybody has the same reaction at the same time. And it really shows Juliette Binoche to be a very, very good sport, because mostly the actors do not come out of this very well. They make themselves look ridiculous in all sorts of ways.
Well, that sounds like that's my evening sorted. Thank you very much, Lucy. And that is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Alice Wadsworth, David Baddiel, Toby Lichtig and David Gallagher. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.